Good morning. I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News, and I'm at the studios of KPCC, our sister station in Pasadena, California, this week. The Climate Cast with Paul Huttner is coming up a bit later. But first, we're in depth on why more states are debating and passing doctor-assisted death. California is the largest. The measure approving it has been signed into law, but there are delays as to when it will actually take effect here. We'll explain. Washington, Vermont, Montana have joined Oregon in approving it, and lawmakers are debating it this month in Colorado. New Mexico may follow. Physician-assisted suicide will become legal in Canada as well. Today, as two guests join us, we're going to examine how American opinion is apparently changing about doctor-assisted suicide. And why? And I hope your views will inform our conversation. Are you among the Americans whose opinion on assisted death have changed either way? Is it because of a situation that you faced within your family or your circle of friends? So we're trying to talk this morning about how American opinion on this issue, as evidenced by what's happening in some of these states, is evolving and why that is. And I'd love to have your own experience on this. Have you faced a situation among your circle of friends or within your family that altered your views either way about the idea of this? Here's the phone number, 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. Steph Curtis hanging out at nprnews.org/live, and I'm on Twitter at CarrieNPR. Our guest today, Dr. Felicia Cohn, is with us. She's bioethics director at Kaiser Permanente and professor of ethics at UC Irvine, and with us today from Southern California. And Professor Cohn, welcome. It's really good to have you on the show.
Well, thank you for having me.
Dr. Sumita Puri is with us. She's a palliative medicine doctor at the University of Southern California, and she's with me in the studio. And Dr. Puri, welcome. It's good to have you on the show.
Thank you for having me.
When you came in, before we went on the air, we had a conversation about the language of this, and you said the language is really important. I said, is there a reason we shouldn't be calling this doctor-assisted suicide? And you said there is. Why?
I think in general, the language around death and dying and the conversations I have every day with my patients, the language is absolutely central to how we talk about death and dying and to understanding where they're coming from. And when I first heard the term physician-assisted suicide, it caused and it still causes me to take some pause. Because I think when we think about the word suicide, it's an intentional act. And oftentimes, we don't understand the reasons why a patient or a person in general might pursue it. When I think of the word suicide, I also think of something that is done secretively and that leaves the people who love that person wondering why. When we talk about physician-assisted suicide, generally what we're thinking of is an act that is not hidden or shameful. There are usually family or loved ones involved in the decision-making process, or at least aware of the decision-making process, if not present at the time that a patient would take the medications. So even though it meets the dictionary definition of suicide in that somebody is taking their life, the situation feels very different to me.
Professor Cohn, how much do you think the language around this influences changing American opinion, the way we think about it? Does it matter?
Oh, I think it matters a great deal. You know, the shift from calling it physician-assisted suicide to physician aid in dying really signaled the change in acceptance of the practice. Suicide, you know, is stigmatized, and suicide, you know, even under insurance, is often, you know, you can't collect insurance benefits if you've committed suicide. There are lots of stigmas, lots of negativity associated with suicide. It's considered something that, you know, if you're considering, you need psychiatric treatment, whereas physician aid in dying suggests that you're reaching out for help. And really, these people, when someone's suffering from a terminal illness, they're not looking to end their lives. If they could change their situation, they would want to continue living. They just don't want to live as they are living with whatever illness they have, suffering as they are. So they're seeking aid to end that suffering. They're not looking to end their lives. They're looking to end their suffering. So that change in terminology was really important in highlighting that. The problem with the change is it still it still doesn't accurately capture what's going on in terms of the agency who's doing.
And tell me why not? You're saying even using the phrase physician-assisted death does not, you don't think, encompass really what we're talking about here. Why?
Well, physician-assisted death could really mean a lot of other things. Like, I would consider hospice care or palliative care to be physician aid in dying. We are helping this individual through this difficult time as they approach the end of their life. And physician aid in dying, as the law has encapsulated it, you really are talking about a person who is taking their own life. So, you know, the semantics are very important metaphorically, religiously, culturally, socially, but we haven't quite found the right term yet.
Got it. Dr. Puri, you also said as a palliative medicine physician, you feel pretty ambivalent about this. Why?
Pretty ambivalent about physician-assisted death?
Yes. Yeah. Just overall, that because you have interaction with patients who are suffering, but you said you feel really divided about whether people, what it takes to bring people to the point that they might choose something like this. Tell me why.
So I think one of the big reasons that I feel ambivalent about it is because the specialty I practice, palliative medicine and hospice, those are both also options, as Felicia has said, in helping people to achieve a dignified and peaceful end of their lives. And those options are not equally accessible throughout the state of California to all patients. And so when I think about what it means to really offer patients a full range of options, to me, I'm uncomfortable that, for example, I had a patient just this week who lives in the Central Valley of California, but was seeking attention at our medical center. Mm-hmm. And I really felt that a home-based palliative care team would have been an excellent resource for her, but one wasn't available where she lives. And so my ambivalence about the law really stems from making something accessible to many people throughout the state when other options are not also equally accessible.
Felicia, this is kind of how the conversation went before we went on air, because then I asked Dr. Puri, well, if we have the capability to address the symptoms, that the suffering that brings people to the point where they feel like death is really the best option, what is happening with all these medical professionals along the way before these people get to that point?
Well, our culture is very focused on healing and curing. And so we tend to spend most of our time trying to find ways to beat the illness, to defy death. You know, there's a, you know, Woody Allen, I think it was, once said, you know, in California, death is optional. And it sometimes can feel that way in a hospital. So, you know, we work really hard to do that until it becomes clear that it's just not going to happen. And then it becomes very difficult to accept hospice services or palliative care services, even if they are available to you. And there are a lot of restrictions on the application of those services. You have to meet very specific criteria to qualify for that benefit. And some patients don't qualify even if they could benefit for the services. And so I think sometimes people feel like they're pushed into a corner where they have no other choice if they want to end their suffering.
Yeah, I mean, I was looking at what Governor Brown said when he signed the law. And we should say that it is not yet in effect in California. Right, Professor? It's been signed into law, but it isn't in effect.
Right. It will not go into effect until 90 days after the end of the current special session.
Okay.
And we don't yet know when that will be.
complicated parliamentary stuff going on here in California.
Yes.
But when the governor signed the bill, he said, if I were dying in prolonged and excruciating pain, it would be a comfort to be able to consider the options afforded by this bill. It is this perception, right, that you are helpless before the suffering and that that you have to have this option if those are your only choices. And I wonder if that's really the right way to have framed this debate. What do you think?
You know, it's a debate over the decades has been framed as this issue of suffering versus choice.
Right.
And I think that really oversimplifies the situation. There are so many services available, even for a patient who doesn't qualify for the hospice benefit under Medicare. There are still so many options available for palliative treatments, for comfort care, that we should be looking at those and really building that infrastructure, building that system where we take care of people as they're dying before we resort to aid in dying, which really should be the last resort, I think, for those patients experiencing that intractable pain, that pain that we just can't treat, or other forms of suffering that we just can't treat with all of our modern medicine and technology.
Dr. Pori, what would you say about that?
I completely agree. And I think that, you know, one of the things I'd like to do is actually clarify what palliative medicine and hospice are.
Uh-huh.
Because I will say almost every day I get a question about how to pronounce palliative medicine, or even sometimes how to pronounce hospice, or even what hospice is. And so I think what Felicia has said, a nice next thing I could be helpful with is just clarifying, what do we mean when we say palliative medicine? What do we mean when we say hospice? So palliative medicine is a subspecialty of medicine that focuses specifically on relief of suffering for patients with advanced illness. So palliative medicine and palliative care can begin well before the time where somebody is in the process of dying.
So it isn't, I go get the palliative care in my final days.
Not at all.
You're saying you come to us well before that.
Yes. In an ideal situation, and more medical studies are supporting that the earlier palliative medicine specialists are involved with a patient's care when they have an advanced progressive illness, which each and every one of us will have mm-hmm. at some point, then the better the outcomes for that patient and family will be. And specifically, we work as a team. So I'm the physician on the team. I have a wonderful social worker. And we work together to understand the multiple components of suffering. Physical suffering, so intractable pain, certainly something I see on a daily basis. Emotional suffering, spiritual suffering, and existential suffering. Finding meaning in an existence that may be increasingly challenged by the ways that the body is naturally breaking down. And we use a multidisciplinary team to address every component of suffering because we understand it's not only physical, that people are really looking to find meaning in of their lives and even meaning in their impending deaths. Hospice is a type of palliative medicine that is specifically for patients in the last 6 months of life. You can get palliative medicine in a clinic in some places, often in the hospital, and you can get hospice at home, which is where most hospice services are delivered, or even in a nursing home. Unfortunately, there are very few standalone hospice facilities, which is, I think, is what people imagine when I say the word hospice.
Right. They think they're going to a place.
Exactly.
Right. And it's the end.
And that's right. Exactly right. And I will tell you, many times I've been asked to see a patient who, you know, for example, has requested to talk to me about physician-assisted death.
Mm-hmm.
One of the most important parts of that conversation is understanding where that question is coming from. And one of the patients I recently saw had uncontrolled pain, and that was why he felt that he would rather die than live in that kind of pain. And he didn't know that there was a team that could help with that, and that's our team. He also thought that he could only get hospice if he was in the last hours of life. So there's a lot of misconceptions about hospice and palliative medicine out there, both from the point of view of physicians and other healthcare professionals, as well as patients and families. So that misinformation, I think, is something that we as a system need to address. And
I was going to say, let's invite some listeners in, and maybe mm-hmm. we'll hear more about these misconceptions or mm-hmm. questions about understanding. If you've just tuned in to the discussion, I'm out in Southern California this week, and we're having a conversation about the fact that California and a number of other states have approved physician-assisted death. We've talked about the language here at the beginning of the discussion. It has not gone into effect yet here in California, but a number of other states and Canada, looking at this, I don't know if there has been a full-fledged debate in Minnesota. Perhaps if there are some state legislators listening this morning, you can let me know where that's at in Minnesota. But our conversation this morning with Dr. Sumita Puri, she's a palliative medicine doctor at the University of Southern California, And Professor Felicia Cohn with us, bioethics director at Kaiser Permanente. As you listen in, I want to know if you're among the Americans whose opinion on assisted suicide or death has changed either way. Is it because of a situation that you encountered within a circle of friends or within your family? And maybe that shaped, maybe that influenced the way you think about this. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, and to the phones, to Pete in St. Paul. Good morning, Pete. Thanks so much for waiting. Really appreciate it.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm a 51-year-old Irish Catholic, and I had an aortic rupture in La Jolla back in July.
Wow.
And died. And then was brought back at UCSD. I've since come back to St. Paul. And what I can tell you is, having gone through that near-death experience and having coded four times during, 19 hours of open-heart surgery, I can tell you that my opinion of whether or not someone should be able to elect to end their life has changed. Mm. I think that I have autonomy over my body, and I have a right to decide when it's time to go. I'm glad I'm back. I'm glad I'm here for my kids and for my wife. But I can tell you that there isn't any doctor or any lawyer or any priest or anyone else that can tell me when it's my time to go. And when it is my time to go, I want to have the option to be able to choose that time and choose it in a way that makes my life peaceful. Having been through that near-death experience, I can assure you, if you haven't been through anything like that, it will change your perspective on whether or not you would choose to end your own life in order to bring yourself to peace.
I'm really glad for the call, Pete. Professor, what are you hearing that?
Well, first, I'm so sorry about all you've been through, and I am glad to hear you are doing well now. And I think this is very representative of why people want this right. They want this option. I think what it misses, though, is all the other alternatives that are out there. You know, if you are experiencing a terminal illness or anything that can threaten your life, you have options. You can create an advance directive, which is a legal document in which you can state your preferences for treatment. So if you don't want to go through that kind of treatment again, you can say that. You can specify conditions. You can specify time-limited trials, that you want to try treatment for a certain amount of time and then stop it. You can, if you have a life-threatening condition, you can, in a lot of states, complete a form called a PULSE, or an order for life-sustaining treatment, that would make it make your preferences known, make it a medical order that you not have certain kinds of treatments. And you can look to palliative care programs. So if you want a comfortable and dignified death, you can reach out to those programs, to palliative care or hospice, and make sure that your death is as comfortable and dignified as possible without having to look to a lethal prescription to do that. And you know, what we also have to remember is in a lot of these circumstances, patients won't be able to take advantage of the law. And I think that's something that's really important to point out, because if you have just experienced a major cardiac event, you're in a hospital, you're probably not awake and alert in order to make those kinds of decisions. And in order to exercise this right to physician aid in dying, you have to be able to make the decision yourself. You have to be able to make the request yourself. There's a waiting period. You have to make a second request. There are other steps in between, and then you're given a lethal prescription, a medication that can help you end your life, and you have to be able to take and swallow that medication yourself. And a lot of the patients, a lot of the situations that we think of as worse than death are situations in which we wouldn't be able to do those things.
Dr. Puri, I think it's also notable to look at some context out of Oregon here. In the last 17 years, doctors have written 1,173 prescriptions in assisted death cases. 752 patients have used them. 421 people have not. And these numbers, by the way, come from a group called Compassion and Choices. That's an indication. These are people who, as you have both said, want the option if they get to the point where they decide they can't bear it. But a number of people never use it. What does that tell you?
So I think You know, and as this caller so nicely shared, there is very much a desire to have control.
Right.
At that time, especially when people have gone through illnesses that over which they had no control. And I think what I've heard from patients who have requested this aid in dying, that control and that independence and that, you know, that struggle to maintain dignity are all the subtext of the reasons for the request. And I think that people take a real comfort in knowing that even if they choose not to use it, they at least have that option available should things get to the point where hospice and palliative medicine or visits with their regular doctor are not effective in relieving their suffering. And I think ultimately these are very deeply personal concepts of how we each individually define dignity, how we define suffering, how we define fear, and how we define meaning in life and in death. And that control can be central to all of that.
Let me go back to the phones here and to a state senator. Senator Eaton, hi.
Hi.
Are you with it? Hi. I'm really glad you called. You're out of Brooklyn Center. I knew there had been legislation introduced here. That was your phone. And but I wasn't aware that there had been a full and open debate. Where does it stand in Minnesota?
Well, I have Senate File 1880. It's called the Compassionate Care Act. Mm-hmm. And we did have an informal hearing last session, but it will get a voted on hearing in the Health and Human Services Policy Committee in March.
Do you think the state legislature is ready to move on this, or is it going to take, you know, some sessions of debate around this?
I think it's going to take, you know, a bit of time. I'm just starting the conversation. I've had many listening sessions around the state. My next one's in North Mankato at South Central College on the 20th. And I guess I just wanted to add from what I was hearing the doctors talk that my understanding is 90% of the people who use the Death with Dignity in Oregon were in hospice, and that, in fact, the Death with Dignity bill has improved their hospice program considerably. Yeah. So, you know, there are some situations where no matter how wonderful palliative care is, people just reach a point where they don't want to live like that anymore.
Dr. Puri, is that true?
Yes. So that is accurate. That my understanding is it's 95 or 97% of the people in Oregon who made use of this, of the Death with Dignity law, were already enrolled in hospice. My understanding also from the situation in Oregon from colleagues up there is that when this act was enacted at the time, one of the things that many of the hospice and palliative medicine practitioners felt is that we need to try and make this a last resort. And to make it a last resort, we have to make sure all options are equally strong for patients, including hospice, including palliative medicine. Senator, I completely agree with you that there are situations where suffering is truly intractable. And the approach I take in my practice is that every patient is a different situation. And I am humbled every single day when I practice palliative medicine because you come up against the limits of your greatest intentions and your greatest abilities as a person and as a doctor. And there have been situations where I have felt that, you know, I'm going to try this last trick that I have in my bag, but I feel like I might be reaching my limits. And I think it's really important to approach the practice of palliative medicine in particular with that kind of humility, that there may be a time where someone's physical suffering in particular is so intractable that perhaps we have to explore other options.
And do you say that to the patient, that I may be reaching the limits of what I can do?
I think one of the most important things I can do for them is help set their expectations. Because sometimes people think that once I get involved, their pain will go away entirely. And when I know that might either take a significant amount of time to reach that goal or that goal may be out of our reach, I'm very honest with them about that.
Felicia, this is something that I've wondered about is whether now, obviously, Sumitra has had a number of conversations and she's accustomed to this. But do we have a lot of medical professionals who feel uncomfortable with broaching these discussions? And that's why there's a lot of confusion around it. And what do we do about that if that's true?
Oh, yes, that's absolutely true. Death is always going to be hard. And for medical professionals, you know, physicians in particular, they've gone to school to learn how to save life, to heal, to cure. And that is what their education focuses on. They have very little training in how to have these conversations about what happens when we reach the limits of medicine. What do we do at that point? How do we talk to this patient, this family, about making those very difficult decisions that mean letting go of someone they love, letting go of a life they want to continue living? And that's true no matter what age the patient is, no matter how severe the condition they have is. It just is very hard. So the primary focus or the bias in medicine is to continue treating. So it becomes very difficult to have a conversation about what do we do if we can't treat? What do we do if you don't want to live the way you have to live while we treat? And we don't have a lot of physicians who want to go there, and palliative care teams have really come in to help with that. And I think one of the things that Oregon really should be commended for is working on that infrastructure. They saw the passage of that law as an indictment, essentially, of their healthcare system.
Wow.
They weren't providing access to the kinds of treatment people need at the end of life to assure dignity, to maintain comfort. And they wanted to work hard to make sure that physician aid in dying would be a last resort, that it would be available and accessible in a non-judgmental way, but that it would be a last resort after they had exhausted all other options.
Here's Joe on Twitter who says he agrees with supporting that physician-assisted death be legal. He says, strip away the religion and the excuses, and you're left with people suffering immensely. Of course, it should be legal. And to the phones to Charlotte in Big Lake, Minnesota. Hey, Charlotte, thank you so much for waiting.
Happy to be on and share some thoughts. Background, 5 months ago, diagnosis of stage 4 breast cancer, kind of a surprise.
I am so
4 months
sorry.
Ago, started palliative care. And as far as the suffering relating the end of death goes, I think we need to be aware that that psychological, incredible suffering begins way before then. It begins with the terminal diagnosis.
Mm-hmm.
And it took me personally to a place that was so deep and so dark and so sad and so filled with fear and helplessness that I'm grateful to be out of it. It took about 4 months. But during that time, what I thought about was, oh, what I wouldn't give to know there's an option for my family versus all the care that will be needed to take care of me. And quite honestly, I wanted an option for myself because I don't know that I'll be strong enough. So there you have it. If you have any questions for a stage 4 person, I'd be happy to answer them.
Charlotte, I'm curious about whether you are now consulting with a palliative care physician.
I was diagnosed 5 months ago. 4 months ago, I began consultation with palliative care.
Okay. Has that been
Not
helpful?
Well, yes, indeed. I think it was part of what brought me out of that deepest, darkest place. And yes, there is just no question that it's been helpful in many ways. My palliative care doctor was able, for instance, to make me see that, no, it was not time to climb in bed and die with hospice. It was time to get my shit together and reach higher ground. And I think part of that was...
Go ahead, Dr. Puri. I think you've heard what she had to say.
Oh, I just heard her get cut off. So is
yeah.
That, oh, okay. All
Go
right.
Ahead.
So I'm so sorry for what Charlotte is going through. And I think she speaks very bravely and honestly about the experience of people who get a diagnosis that's come out of nowhere. And as much as we can know intellectually, we are all mortal. When you get that diagnosis, it is life altering in a way that she's found good words to express.
Mm-hmm.
I think that, again, what I hear her speaking to is the comfort of having an option. so that not only she won't suffer, but that her family also won't. And I think that's really one of the shifts I've seen in the dialogue around this, is that people recognize that there might be other options, but they want to take comfort in that particular one. Again, to have some sense of control at that time. But I think what she's saying about her consultation with a palliative physician is very, very important to hear and to understand, that that actually did help quite a bit for her. And for that, I am grateful that she lives in an area where a palliative medicine physician was accessible to her, because not everybody does. And I'm so grateful that she is accepting of that assistance. And my heart goes out to her.
Felicia, just if you'd reflect for a minute on what Charlotte said and what she's going through.
Well, it's something all of us don't want to imagine, but it's very real. And it's something that many of us will face. You know, unless we are fortunate enough to have the quick death in our sleep, many of us will face months to years suffering through an illness, whether it's physical suffering or not. And what I heard Charlotte say, not that's that she wanted an option not just for her but for her family. And I think that's one of the understated benefits of palliative care and hospice, that they not only support the patient, but support the family. They're there with social workers, with chaplains, to help the family get through what they're going through, because this is a loss not just for that individual of, you know, the life they had and the future they expected, but also for their loved ones who are dealing with losing that person. And palliative care programs, hospice programs, help the family get through this time too, even providing grief counseling after an individual has passed away.
You know, I just want to say that it is notable how much compassion both of you bring to this. I know you've been steeped in these issues for a long time, but I really hear the compassion in the way both of you are thinking about this and interacting with our listeners, and I'm grateful for that. To the phones, to Linda in Minneapolis. Hi, Linda. Thank you so much for waiting. Hi.
Hi. This is a little bit different, but my thinking about assisted death has been brought into question. I'd always thought, no, I would never help anyone do that. I would never, ever do it. Mm-hmm. But this last year, my son took his life after years and years of suffering with depression.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing that troubled me perhaps more than anything else was that he couldn't ask anyone to stand by him at that terrible moment when he finally did this deed, that he had to be all alone. And That just has bothered me so much. And it makes me think, isn't there, I suppose I'm making a plea for mental health care, for improvement in that, but this son had been suffering from mental illness for 15 years without a break, even though he was going to the doctors that he was supposed to be going to. And he was trying very, very hard to find ways to overcome the depression. He couldn't do it. So then, what option is there?
Linda, I guess I'm interested in whether that has, in this experience, and I'm sorry for that, has influenced how you feel about physician-assisted death.
Yes, I think it has. It doesn't seem to me like such an absolute no anymore.
Okay.
Because, just knowing his suffering and he couldn't get out of it, well, maybe there is a time to help someone.
Thank you, Linda. Felicia, where does mental illness fit in here?
Well, that's one of the frustrating things about this law. I mentioned before that the law would be limited in its application. And to safeguard our society from abuses of the law, most of the laws, in fact, all of the laws, have all these safeguards built in, so that it can only be used in the context of a terminal diagnosis. So somebody with chronic depression, somebody with mental illness, is probably not going to have a terminal diagnosis. Yes, depression, of course, we recognize the risk to life from potential suicides, but it wouldn't be considered a terminal diagnosis, so he probably wouldn't have qualified for this law. And for some patients like that as well, if their illness is impairing their decision-making, you know, if it's interfered with their ability to make decisions for themselves, they might not qualify in that way either.
But you know, it does affect your quality of life. Dr. Puri, come in on this. Aren't you every bit as bleak and troubled as somebody with a terminal diagnosis if you have the kind of mental illness that, as Felicia says, you see no other choices? I mean, how do we think about that in this?
I think that that is an area of great debate within palliative medicine as well. And I know that there are countries abroad that have considered physician-assisted death for patients with mental illness. Mm-hmm. I'm not very well versed in how, in the criteria or how that evaluation process goes, but I have seen tremendous emotional and mental suffering and spiritual suffering for patients with terminal diagnoses. I have less experience with what this caller and her son went through, and I'm so sorry for that experience. But I do think that, unfortunately, in medicine and in palliative medicine, there's just a lot of controversy around whether emotional suffering constitutes a reason to assist someone
to
in their dying.
Felicia, do you have an opinion on that? Do you see the day when maybe this is not as controversial the way it is now, and that more states move to being open to that? And should they, in your view?
To expanding...
Yes.
The criteria for applying?
Yeah.
I don't know. There's a lot of concern about what in philosophy we call slippery slopes. You know, where do we draw the line? Who should have access to this and what conditions? And right now we really have limited it just to those facing the end of life. And the concern is that there may be coercion for people who are suffering without dying, you know, before they're dying, into making these decisions because, you know, it could be a lot less expensive. It's a lot less difficult to just help these people die rather than try to take care of them.
You know, I was looking at some of the Gallup polling on this, and I noticed the generational differences in this. Felicia, maybe you've noticed this. Gallup reporting that among 18 to 34-year-olds, support for physician-assisted death has risen by 19%. It's increased among other age groups as well. How much did the Brittany Maynard case influence, do you think, the way younger people are thinking about this?
Well, I think putting a public face on any issue is always going to be a strong influence. You know, it becomes not a theoretical, but a real situation, a real issue that we can relate to. And we can all imagine being Brittany. What if I had that diagnosis? What if I was living with that pain, with that fear? What if my life was going to be cut short in this way that's unimaginable to most of us? And once it becomes relatable, it becomes easier to accept. I think also generationally, the emphasis on autonomy, on choice, on being able to make your own decisions, to have self-determination, increases, the value of that increases with each generation. Ever since the patients' rights movement started in the 1960s, it's become a greater and greater value.
I should say, for anybody who's not familiar with it, she was a 29-year-old woman who was diagnosed with terminal brain cancer, and she advocated for doctor-assisted death. And I just wanted to play a little bit from a statement that she recorded before her death for the legislature. It was played posthumously after she died. But here's Brittany Maynard.
I may be minimally conscious, still suffering, and unable to move or speak. That terrifies me. Death with dignity is a much swifter and peaceful way to pass.
And she ended up doing that, Dr. Puri, didn't she?
She did. Yes.
Let me grab a call here from Daniel in St. Paul. Hey, Daniel, hi. Thanks for waiting.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for having me on. I'm a palliative medicine fellow at the University of Minnesota, and there's been some talk so far about sort of some thought that there's a necessary aspect of physician-assisted suicide or death, that it needs to be an option available. And I was wondering from our hosts if how many situations you've run into where, through the tools we have at our disposal in palliative medicine, how many situations where the suffering is so great that there's a need to have physician-assisted suicide as an option. I guess I'm thinking specifically more about palliative sedation and other things that we can utilize as ways in which to relieve suffering. And
right.
I just humbly admit that I don't have too much experience running into scenarios where I felt like I had no options available to me to relieve the suffering further.
Dr. Puri, what about that?
So that's a great question, and I thank you for asking it. I have had in my experience 5 situations, and this is throughout my training and my attending practice, where the option of palliative sedation, which I'd like to explain, has been utilized. And palliative sedation is what I think of as our last resort prior to the passage of the Aid in Dying Law as a way to relieve people of suffering. So the specific definition, usually we try everything we possibly can to relieve intractable symptoms. Pain is the one we think of most often, but in 3 of the 5 cases that I use palliative sedation for, shortness of breath was actually the reason why we pursued that route of treatment. And what it essentially means is that when we have used every tool we possibly can to keep people comfortable and it's not working, we use medications to help them achieve rest and sleep. It's really important to understand that the intention and the goal of palliative sedation is not to hasten death, but rather to give people rest.
To give them comfort while they are dying. Dr. Puri, thank you very much for being here. Really good to have you.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Professor Cohn, thank you very much for joining us this morning. I really do appreciate it.
Thank you very much for including me.
And thank you very much to everyone who called. I mean, with your own stories, your own situations, I really appreciate how you informed the discussion.